You probably haven't heard of Cher Ami. His name means dear friend. He carried an important message that saved the lives of almost 200 men. This messenger barely made it to his destination. By the time he arrived, he had a bullet wound. He was blinded in one eye. He died from his injuries less than a year later. In fact, Cher Ami came from a long line of messengers. His ancestors had been messengers. His whole life had been training to become a messenger. All that he was supposed to do in life was to carry a message to the right people. Cher Ami was a pigeon. How many of you saw that coming? All right, good. First service, second service, about equal. He was a carrier pigeon. Maybe one of the most famous carrier pigeons ever to deliver a message. In fact, his body is now mounted at the Smithsonian. Here's our dear friend, Cher Ami, our one-legged carrier pigeon. His message revealed the location of the 77th Infantry Division during World War I. See, they'd been surrounded by Germans, and they sent out a first carrier pigeon, but they gave the wrong coordinates. And so then the U.S. Army started bombing them instead of the enemy, which, that's not good. So they sent out two other carrier pigeons, both of which were shot down by the Germans. Cher Ami was the fourth pigeon to leave. He was shot as well, but managed to make it 25 miles to carry the message of the proper coordinates and save this entire division. Some messages are really important. Some messages are difficult to deliver. Some messages are a matter of life and death. This morning, as Andrea said, we're continuing in our series in the book of Revelation. One of the themes we've seen throughout this series is the idea of being a messenger, of being a witness to what you've seen and conveying that information to people who haven't seen it. John himself, the author of the book, is a witness. He is commissioned as a prophet to carry this message that Jesus gives him and to deliver the message to the world. The book opened where Jesus appeared to John and spoke to him of this calling to be a prophet. And then Jesus gave John seven letters to be delivered to the seven churches in his region, carrying instructions for what God wanted for them. Then John was invited up into the throne room of heaven in chapters 4 and 5. And we saw this scroll that contained the plan of redemption for the world that John was supposed to understand and deliver. That scroll was sealed with seven seals. And then we saw the first six seals being broken. And then there was an intermission in the story where we saw God sealing his people. When the seventh seal was opened, then we saw the seven trumpets come out, and we heard the sounding of the first six trumpets. And now we get to this chapter, chapter 10, and we take another little intermission in between the first six and the final of a series. And what I think God is doing here is he's speaking to John in the midst of all that's going on and just reminding him, before we go any further, of what his calling is. God is bringing John back to the main point of all of this, that John is being given a message to deliver to the world. And I think in this passage, we're being given the same reminder. You will be encouraged this morning to remember your calling. If you are a follower of Jesus Christ, you are commissioned as a messenger of good news. It's not a simple calling. It's not easy to fulfill. It can get very complicated, and sometimes it's dangerous or causes us pain. Think about the carrier pigeon statistics. One delivers the wrong message, two get shot down, and only one, wounded, barely makes it carrying the right message. Not great statistics, but probably about what we face in terms of being messengers of the gospel to our world. Much of this book, the book of Revelation, is meant to encourage people suffering, encountering pain, as they try to be faithful. And the whole overall picture is, as you've said, to wake up to the spiritual reality and to be encouraged to faithfully continue in the midst of challenges. How do we then faithfully continue as witnesses. What does it look like for us to be encouraged in our calling? Several years ago, when I was in college at Stanford, I was going for a walk around the lake. And this was kind of a typical thing I would do as kind of a prayer walk or just time to myself. And I was completing my walk and I was coming back to my dorm and I saw somebody sitting by the lake. They had their face in their hands and they looked upset. And I thought, you know, I should probably go talk to this person. Maybe I could help them, encourage them. And then, no, that'd be weird. They'd probably want to be alone, but maybe God is telling me I should go talk to them. But no, I don't know if I really want to. And it's kind of in this dilemma. Well, we'll get back to that story in a minute. First, let's take a look about what God says to John and how he encourages him in his calling. Let me pray for us. God, thank you for this book. Thank you for revealing yourself in your word. Thanks for the reminders that it gives us and for the constant encouragement of just knowing you care for us enough to guide us and lead us. I pray that as we study these words and as we allow them to affect us, that you would be speaking to each of our hearts. You know what we need to hear. You know what we're coming in here with, where we're at in our relationship with you, whether we're tired or excited or lonely or encouraged or wondering, looking for direction. God, I pray you would speak through these words into our hearts what you want us to hear this morning. Send your spirit. In the name of Jesus, amen. Well, the passage this morning opens, as a lot of Revelation does, with this grand cosmic vision. Here's Revelation 10, the first four verses. Then I saw another mighty angel coming down from heaven, wrapped in a cloud with a rainbow over his head. And his face was like the sun and his legs like pillars of fire. He had a little scroll open in his hand. And he set his right foot on the sea and his left foot on the land and called out with a loud voice like a lion roaring. When he called out, the seven thunders sounded. And when the seven thunders had sounded, I was about to write, but I heard a voice from heaven saying, seal up what the seven thunders have said and do not write it down. Can you see this picture? Angel coming down from heaven, wrapped in a cloud, wearing a rainbow. His right foot is planted on the water. His left foot is planted on the land. He's standing above all of creation. He bellows forth his voice, and it sounds like seven thunders. And if you've been reading along at this point in the book of Revelation, you go, okay, I know what this is all about. We've had seven letters to the churches. We've had seven seals. We've had seven trumpets. Now we have seven thunders. And we say, okay, I know this is probably another series of judgments. This is another set of what God is going to do to his world because he cares about justice. But these seven thunders are different. See, it's not what we are prepared to see because John begins to write it down, but the angel stops him. He says, no, seal up these thunders. What they have said, do not record. Don't write it down. Why would that be? In the Old Testament, there was a prophet named Daniel. He was actually told to seal up his words too. Listen to Daniel 12, verse 4. But you, Daniel, shut up the words and seal the book until the time of the end. Well, that makes sense for Daniel. He was Old Testament, but now we're at the time of the end. These are the words of the end. So why would John be told to seal them up? It's even more confusing if you look at the end of the book, Revelation 22, verse 10. These are some of the final instructions John is given. And he said to me, do not seal up the words of the prophecy of this book, for the time is near. And so John's clearly being told to take what he's seen and share it with the world, not to keep it hidden. Why then are the thunders sealed? Have you ever gotten pulled over by a police officer? I won't ask you to raise your hands. Of course I haven't, actually I have. But I hear it's a very scary experience, right? I mean, you have that pit in your stomach, you see the lights, you get pulled over. have the conversation, license, registration, what did you do? Do you know why I pulled you over? Yes, blah, blah, blah. You know, you're worried, well, what's going to happen? And then sometimes, if you're lucky, those magic words, I'm going to let you off with a warning. Yes, right? Ticket averted, the fines and the point on your record and all the hassle, you get off. And from then on, you vow to never speed again, right? Going to let you off with a warning. I think that's what's going on with these thunders. There's several different views about what might be happening here, about why John is told to seal them up. But the view that makes the most sense to me is that these are, again, a set of seven judgments that God might have unleashed on the world, but these judgments are held back. These are things that could have happened, but that won't happen. For whatever reason, God has chosen not to unleash these particular judgments on the world. What a refreshing relief that must be in the midst of this book with so much pain and so much devastation. Last week, we saw God give away the key to the bottomless pit and the horrors that came forth. We've been thinking about these judgments as mostly God allowing the natural consequences of sin to play out. And so last week, we saw how God unleashes his hand. He takes away his hand and he lets the consequences of our choices be felt in our lives so that we might turn to him. But instead, we blame him and we hate him all the more. This is a book of God allowing things to happen. But here, in chapter 10, he says, no, seal up these words. Do not write them down. Even in the midst of judgment, even in the midst of allowing our consequences to take place, there's mercy and grace. The other day, I texted my wife and asked her, can we go for a walk when I get home? And she texted back, is there anything in particular you wanted to talk about? And I kind of understood she was thinking, is this one of those, can we go for a walk, we need to talk kind of things? And I said, no, I just thought we'd go for a walk. And she said, okay, great, that sounds fun. But I could tell even the text, there's this expectation of judgment. And isn't that the way we are? That we think right around the corner, somebody's about to judge us. And particularly in a book like Revelation, seven thunders, they must be seven judgments. Here's God once again showing us how bad things can be. And we read all these judgments, and I think there's some part of us that goes, I knew it. I knew God was angry at me. He talks about love, he talks about grace, but I knew that God's really disappointed in me, that he's a God of anger. But here, we see in the middle of all of this, grace. This is what lies at the heart of God. God is a God of forgiveness, of inclusion. He redeems. He looks at us with favor. That's what the word grace means. God looks at us, he looks at you with favor. Even though we've turned our backs on him, even as we've sinned, even as we've rejected him, he makes a way for relationship. So as we think about our calling to be messengers, to deliver this message to the world, it helps to start by remembering what's at the core. Remember grace. Personally, I find this really helpful to just be brought back to the basics. There's so many things swirling around us, so many issues and questions. There's theological debates. There's questions about the reputation of Christians. What should we be doing in our world? There's cultural issues we don't know how to address. There's political divisions. There's this constant sense of busyness and frenzy, and I'm not doing enough, and what should I do next? And this question of how do I fit my faith into all of that? How do I even believe, much less? How do I share my faith with someone else? How do I do all that? It's so overwhelming. But at the core of it, it's just grace. And to be brought back to that here in the middle of judgment, to be reminded of that message that first opened me up to God's love. That because of what Jesus has done, because of his forgiveness, I'm enough. God has favor on me God accepts me, even though he knows everything about me. I grew up in church. I knew the ideas. I knew what God was supposed to be like. But it wasn't until I was put in a community of people who accepted me, who treated me like God feels about me, that that became real. So here at the beginning, be reminded of God's favor for you and of God's favor for the world, that this is at the core of what we believe. Don't forget the grace of God. Well, our angel is straddling the earth, and after this instruction to hold back on writing down the thunders, he then proceeds to give instructions to John. Listen to verses 5 through 7. And the angel whom I saw standing on the sea and on the land raised his right hand to heaven and swore by him who lives forever and ever, who created heaven and what is in it, the earth and what is in it, and the sea and what is in it, that there would be no more delay, but that in the days of the trumpet call to be sounded by the seventh angel, the mystery of God would be fulfilled, just as he announced to his servants, the prophets. One of our favorite questions to ask is, how long? I was at the DMV earlier this week, and I was asking that question a lot, as were many people, frustrated people all around me. How long in this line? How long in that line? How long until I do this? But we ask this about all sorts of things in our lives. How long until we arrive at our destination? How much longer in this movie? How long until summer gets here? How long until my kids go back to school? How long until my kids grow up and leave the house? How long until they return and come home? How long until this sermon ends? You may not realize this, but asking how long is a deeply theological activity. Asking how long is giving voice to that part of us within us that wants to see something happen, that wants to see God act, that longs in some way for God to intervene in the events of this world, for him to take notice and do something. In fact, earlier in this book, in Revelation 6, verse 10, we heard God's saints asking exactly this question. Listen to verse 10 of chapter 6. We saw the saints, they were huddled under the altar, and we read, they cried out with a loud voice, O sovereign Lord, holy and true, how long before you will judge and avenge our blood on those who dwell on the earth? They wanted God to act, to intervene in the world, to spare them, to save them, to complete his work of redemption. But others have asked the same question. Daniel, the prophet, asked it right after he heard about sealing his words. Listen to verse 6 of chapter 10. And someone said to the man clothed in linen, who was above the waters of the stream, how long shall it be till the end of these wonders? The psalmists were very fond of asking this question. Listen to Psalm 13, verse 1. How long, O Lord, will you forget me forever? How long will you hide your face from me? Psalm 79, verse 5. How long, O Lord, will you be angry forever? Will your jealousy burn like fire? At the very end of the Old Testament, Habakkuk asked this in chapter 1, verse 2. O Lord, how long shall I cry for help and you will not hear? Or cry to you, violence, and you will not save? See, we are born into a world that's broken and we want God to fix it. And so we learn to ask, how long? How long until things will change? That's the question that the angel in this section is answering. It's a direct response to the saints' cry in chapter 6. How long until you avenge our blood? This is the answer. The angel comes and he says, there will be no more delay. And so the answer that the saints have been asking throughout history is given. The answer to the question that burns in our hearts is given. And here we see God reminding us that he will act. This is the moment when the seventh trumpet sounds, we are told, then the mystery of God will be fulfilled. That moment is coming. Next week we'll see that, and we will see God step in, and we'll see his final work played out through the end of this book. At that time, the mystery will be fulfilled. Until then, we wait. But it helps to know that it's coming. It helps to know that that time is near, that the angel reminds us there will be a time and it is coming soon. You've heard six of the trumpets. When the seventh one sounds, the mystery will be cleared up. You will finally know. You will finally see all that there is to see. Knowing that, we can wait. We can hold on just a little bit longer because we can trust that God's plan is unfolding as he meant it to be. We can trust the plan. If you've ever assembled IKEA furniture, you know about trusting the plan, right? You go and you buy a coffee table and it comes in a box like this. And you buy a couch and it comes in a box like this. Or a dining room table, a box like this. You think, how can all these pieces of furniture look the same? And you open it up and you fiddle with those terrible screws. And this is why I had children, actually, because I vow never to assemble IKEA furniture again. My children are now trained. When they leave the house, we're going to have a church work project or something. But you build it, and finally all these pieces come together, and finally it looks like you think it's going to look. And you realize that there was a plan all along. It was just written in some Scandinavian language that you couldn't understand. As believers, we have to trust that this is how it's going. God knows what he's doing, and he's carrying it forward. And partly the book of Revelation is given to help us remember and trust him. We've talked about how it's tricky to interpret the chronology of this book, that what God is not doing here is giving us a sequence of events so that this and this and this and this and this will happen so that we can recognize them exactly when they happen and we can predict exactly how everything's going to go. I don't think that's what God's doing here, but he is giving us a pattern, a series to say this is in general how history is going to go so that when you see these things happen, don't be confused, but know that it's happening according to plan. So when we see political division, and when we see confusion about sexuality, and hatred between different groups, and the suffering of the poor, and natural disasters, and the increase of people turning away from God, when we see those things, we cannot lose hope and lose heart and wonder where God is, but we can say, this is how God knew it was going to play out. This is how he knew history would go until he steps in one final moment to wrap things up. Someone once gave me directions on how to get to their house. I think this was before Google Maps. And they said, you drive along this road, and then when you think you've gone too far, go a little farther and take the next left. I said, how do you know what I'm going to think? You can't know what I'm going to think, and so I'm just going to go, I'll figure it out. Drive, and it's longer and it's longer, and I think, I've probably gone too far. And then I went a little further, and there was the street. Sure enough, they knew that I was going to lose hope, but then it would work. And I think that's what God's doing here. He's saying, keep going, be faithful, and when you think things have spun completely out of control, when you think there's no way that a loving God could possibly still be in control over the things that are happening now, when you think that the world is a lost cause, when you think I'm sleeping on the job, and when your own faith starts to waver, then I'll act. Then it's a little farther, and there would be no more delay. The trumpet will sound. God knows how things are going to go. He knows that we're going to have a hard time with it. He knows that we'll doubt, that we'll question, that we'll wonder whether he's even there. He gives us this reminder to encourage us that he is. recognize that this pain and suffering we see around us is part of what has to occur for God's plan to take place. And so we begin with this reminder of grace, of God's mercy, of judgment held back. And then we see this encouragement that God is going to act, that he is going to come, and that there will be no more delay. So armed with those two things, now we're ready for the formal reminder of John's calling. Here, we're going to see him recommissioned as a prophet to deliver God's message. Listen to verses 8 through 11. Then the voice that I had heard from heaven spoke to me again, saying, "Go, take the scroll that is open in the hand of the angel who is standing on the sea and on the land." So I went to the angel and told him to give me the little scroll. And he said to me, "Take and eat it. It will make your stomach bitter, but in your mouth it will be sweet as honey." And I took the little scroll from the hand of the angel and ate it. It was sweet as honey in my mouth, but when I had eaten it, my stomach was made bitter. And I was told, "You must again prophesy about many peoples and nations and languages and kings." You may remember that we saw a scroll earlier in the book of Revelation. When we were invited into the throne room of God, we saw this scroll, and we heard the angel lament that no one was found who could open the scroll until Jesus came and opened it. That scroll had six seals, and we saw Jesus breaking those seals. Now we have this little scroll. It's also referred in verse 8 as just the scroll. So we wonder, people wonder, and they write books on this. Is the scroll from earlier the same as the scroll from now? Are they the same scroll, or are they different scrolls? This is what keeps biblical scholars up at night. And my answer is, probably. If they aren't the same, they're certainly related. This first scroll seemed to carry the plan of God's redemption. These were his purposes for the world, and only Jesus could open them. Now, John is given this scroll. Perhaps that's because the seals are already broken. Jesus has broken them. Now he can take them. Perhaps it's a smaller version of the scroll. But that's kind of the interpretation that I find most compelling. One of the commentators said, Jesus has his scroll and we have our scroll. They're essentially the same. Jesus' scroll is the path that he is called to walk on in terms of God's plan of redemption for the world. We have a scroll that mirrors his, that is similar, that calls for our faithful suffering as a witness. And so we walk in the ways that Jesus walked. But we're not alone in our calling. Ezekiel was given a scroll very similar to this one in John. His was also said to be as sweet as honey in his mouth. Daniel was given a charge to preach to nations, languages, and kings, just like John. Jeremiah was appointed a prophet to the nations. Some of Jesus' final words to us were, "Go and make disciples of all nations." So this charge that John receives at the end, that you must prophesy to many peoples and nations and languages and kings, this is a charge that has been given before. It's a charge that's given to us. This is our calling in the world. And so just as Cher Ami stood in a long line of messengers, we stand with this history behind us of faithful men and women who have delivered God's message to the world. But, and this is what's beautiful, we're not just given a message to carry. It's not just some words wrapped up and strapped to our ankle. What does John do with the scroll? He eats it. And that message isn't just something he describes, but it's something that he consumes. The message of God's love, the gospel, the good news of Jesus goes inside of him. It becomes part of him. And so the message of God's gospel comes to us and changes us. We take it inside of us and it changes us from within so that we don't just have a message, but we are a message. We become in our lives, in all of ourselves, the message of God's love to the world. What I love about this passage is that my experience in being a messenger is validated. Sometimes, and certainly when I first heard this message, when it first became real to me, it was sweet as honey. Acceptance and forgiveness and love and inclusion, that was something that was powerful in my life. But there are other times where this message seems bitter and difficult and confusing. Times where I feel like a failure, that I don't understand it or I question it. And so this same message is at the same time both bitter and sweet, because that's how we experience the gospel in our lives. I think maybe John felt that way. Maybe after receiving all of these words of judgment, he needed a little encouragement. He needed to see this message anew. And so God gives him this word, tells him to consume it, and then reminds him, you must again prophesy to many peoples and nations. We don't always want this calling. It's not always pleasant. It's often very challenging. But we are called to tell the world. Tell the world. Remember that person sitting by the lake? I saw them and I wondered, should I go up to them? Should I not? And I'm having this internal dialogue and trying to figure out what to do. And finally I decide, okay, I think God's leading me. I'm going to go talk to them. I turn to talk to them and they're gone. And I felt, much like you feel at the conclusion of my story, disappointment, anticlimax, even a sense of failure. Did I miss an opportunity? Was that God, wasn't it? I don't know. And to be honest, that's often my personal feeling when I think about my calling as a messenger. I wonder if some of you feel that way. Reading this book of Revelation can make it worse in a sense. On the one hand, this book reminds us of the urgency that people know Jesus. Because if this is how history is going to play out, we want people to experience the freedom and the forgiveness of faith. But on the other hand, this book makes it all the more complicated to talk about the gospel, because how do you talk about this? This is so contrary to our culture. How do you even begin to have conversations with people? So here in the middle is an encouragement from God, a gentle reminder that God calls us, but he also empowers us. He nourishes us. He takes care of John in the midst of this. You know, we are fond sometimes of talking about how we ought to go witness about Jesus. We use witness as a verb mostly. But in the Bible, witness is almost always used as a noun. Witness isn't an activity we do. It's an identity that defines us. We are witnesses because God has changed our identity, because he has given us a new life. And so all of our lives are witnesses to the gospel of Jesus. And we have to be comfortable living it out and talking about it. That's not an excuse never to talk about it, but it is something that is within us, that comes out naturally as we experience God's love. And in the midst of that, God sometimes just refreshes us. It always surprises me when God gives me these little gifts, tiny things that I think, does God really care about me with all the people in the world? Maybe it's just a good night's sleep or time of rest, a friendship that encourages me. One time I was standing in my kitchen and the window was open and I was stressed and worried about a lot of things, and just this little breeze came through the window and hit my face, and I felt calmer. And I thought, is that God? Does God care about me enough to just comfort me in my stress? That's crazy, but he does. And so we see John being nourished by this scroll, God showing up to minister to him, to take care of his messenger in the midst of all of this. I think God will do this for us. God will refresh us. He will go with us. When we think it's too far, when we think everything's lost, God will come and give us new hope. Feed us, give us strength for the journey. Eat the scroll and become a witness. We bear a dangerous calling. Our little pigeon friend carried a message. His task was to take a message asking for rescue and fly over the enemies and get rescue to come. Ours is even scarier. We're told to go into the camp of the enemy, to go into the places where people are lost and reject God and don't believe and have all sorts of reasons why. We're told to go in there not asking for rescue, but bringing rescue, bringing good news, but news that's often not perceived as good. You are a messenger. You carry the good news of the gospel. We're given this reminder of grace that at the core of what we communicate is simply God's love and forgiveness for the world. We're given a reminder that God has this whole thing figured out, that his plan is unfolding according to his design. And we're reminded of our calling to go be a prophet to the nations. This isn't something to add on top of what you're already doing. It's not one more thing to do. It's who you are. It's something that happens no matter what else you're doing. It's simply an identity transformation that spills out into all of your life. In the midst of it, God will sustain us and nourish us to do his will. Now, we know, though, that there's a bunch of challenges to being a witness. Sometimes it seems, especially in our culture, it's really hard to figure out how to witness faithfully to the world. So to help us think through that a little bit, we're going to be taking a break from Revelation during the season of Lent. And as preparation leading towards Easter, we're going to be talking specifically about those barriers that we face with people coming to faith in Jesus. We're going to be asking two primary questions. The first is, what barriers are out there in the world that people who don't know Jesus, what are those barriers that keep them from coming to faith? And the second question we'll be asking is, what are those barriers that keep us, that hold us back from being willing or able to share our faith? So we're going to ask your help with this. We've actually designed a brief survey that I'm going to ask you to do right now, where you'll help us to pick what are the most pressing issues for each of those questions that you feel. So we talked about a dangerous calling. We're going to go into dangerous territory here, and you're all going to use our network at the same time. I've been told that's a dangerous idea, but I'm going to ask you to go to pbc.org/barriers. It's a simple two-question survey. Be in prayer. Just pray about what you've experienced. If you don't have a device with you or if your device times out, whatever, pray about this. Pray that God would help you to recall and maybe do this later or after the service or whenever our network gets relaxed. So we're going to take a minute or two. There'll be some nice little background music, pbc.org/barriers, and then I'll close us in prayer. Go ahead.